The State Government Finance and Veterans Affairs Committee will come to order. Today, we are starting with House File 5, which is a very important bill that has to do with the health exchange. And I, as I announced before the meeting began, if you're planning on testifying, please notify Ms. Conley. If you are from Greater Minnesota, please let her know that so that we will make sure to include you in this morning's session for this afternoon's, in this time period before 2 o'clock. Are there representatives from the agencies within our jurisdiction in the audience? Minnesota Management and Budget. Department of Administration. Office of Enterprise Technology. Minute. Legislative Auditor. And the legislature. Ms. Conley, will you get on the phone? Representative Atkins, shouldn't there be people from those agencies?
Madam Chair.
Backup for what you have to say?
And Madam Chair, I would love to have backup from all those folks. My question for the committee is, there's concurrent hearings going on, both in the Senate and the House at the same time. And my understanding, and perhaps incorrectly, was that there'd likely be a brief walkthrough of the bill by the author, but then you're taking testimony today about whatever people's issues or questions may be, and hopefully that'll give an opportunity for anybody that you need to have be here to get them here.
Okay. And Miss Conley has one of those modern devices that can contact people too, so I appreciate that. Representative Atkins, will you tell us about House File 1 and the importance of the health exchange to Minnesota?
I'd be happy to, Madam Chair, and thank you for the opportunity, and thank you for the recognition of folks who came here from Greater Minnesota. If they want to testify, I certainly want to give them the opportunity. They had a little bit more of a struggle probably with the weather the last several hours and last couple days than somebody like me who lives half an hour or 20 minutes from the Capitol. The fact is, folks, there will be an online health insurance marketplace in Minnesota. The only question administratively is who's going to operate it. Will it be a Minnesota-run version, or will it be federally imposed? That's really up to us, Madam Chair, because if we fail to adopt a Minnesota version of a online health insurance marketplace by March 31st, the default is that it will be run, it will be imposed, and we will be sending money to the federal government to do it for us. So there's several questions that have come up in various committees, and I've tried to refine those down to ones, Madam Chair, that I think this committee would be most interested in the realm of state government finance. And the first one is what I just talked about, is who will run it. And that's whether we want a federally run health insurance marketplace or a state run health insurance marketplace, since Minnesota for a long, long time has sort of set ourselves apart relative to our health care and our health insurance marketplace. I think it's pretty much uniform that most people would prefer to have it be a Minnesota-grown, Minnesota-run health insurance marketplace. The second question that comes up is how will it work? And the fact is by the time we're done, come January, and actually come March, but it should be up and running, is you should be able to pull out your computer or your laptop or your iPad and get online and shop in an apples-to-apples way in a competitive fashion for your health insurance. That's for small businesses, for entrepreneurs, and for individuals and families. Is to go on and literally compare products that would make sense for you and your family or you and your business in a competitive fashion, something that we currently don't have. There are, just so we're clear, there's, in fact, I was on one this morning. You can go online right now and look at products online, but it doesn't do the enrollment. It doesn't do the eligibility determination. It doesn't allow you to access public programs. It doesn't allow you to access federal tax credits. So there's a lot of shortcomings that are in the world right now that will be accommodated by the result of having a health insurance marketplace. How will it be paid for is a question that comes up, and I would expect that it will come up in this committee as well. The federal version would be done by an arbitrary 3.5% withhold of any premiums that are paid for online. So if you go online and you pay $1,000 a month for your health insurance, you would pay an automatic $35 of that would go towards paying for the federal health insurance exchange. Minnesota thinks we can do it for less, we think we can do it better and for less money. So we've said it would be up to 3.5. The latest projection is about 2.25%. So if you had a apples-to-apples, $1,000 a month health insurance premium, we think we can, for about $22.50, allow you to purchase your health insurance. The Senate now, and I don't want to talk too much about the Senate bill, but you may have heard they want to do it via tobacco funds, and which unfortunately would leave a little bit of a hole in the general fund using tobacco tax dollars. The question comes up frequently: will it save people money? There is, as folks know, we got to make sure that we're talking about the two separate things. One is we've got the Affordable Care Act, which is guaranteed issue. Everybody is guaranteed to be able to get health insurance, whether they got a pre-existing condition or not. So the expectation is that as a result of the Affordable Care Act, premiums will in fact go up as a result of that. And I've heard numbers in the neighborhood 15% to 29% is an expected figure by which premiums would go up. The exchange itself, the health insurance marketplace, should cause the net premium to actually go down. That's a result of two things. Number one is we've got competition. And as we know in America, competition tends to drive prices in one direction, and that is down. Secondly, is it's the only way that you can access federal tax credits. And the net of those two things, competition and the federal tax credit, is that the average Minnesota family is anticipated to save $490 as a result of purchasing their health insurance through the health insurance marketplace here in Minnesota. There will be some families that will save considerably more than that. I've seen estimates from MIT's health economist, is the fellow that gave us these numbers, somewhere in the neighborhood of $1,700 or $1,800 a year. Is what some folks would save. But keep in mind, some people, in fact, my family, if we purchased ours through this, would save nothing. We would not qualify for the federal health care tax credits. We wouldn't save anything at all. So as a result of the Affordable Care Act and guaranteed issue and all of that, we'd probably pay a little bit more. Not as a result of the exchange, but simply as a result of the fact that we've got a different kind of model that we're using for buying health insurance nationally. Let's talk businesses for a second, and then, Madam Chair, I've got one final item, and then be happy to take questions. But the impact on businesses is significant. There's anticipated savings as a result of MCHA winding down of over $150 million a year. In addition to that, businesses, as a result of the competitive nature and being able to, and this is one of the frustrations for me and my little law firm, we don't have a whole lot of leverage when we buy health insurance right now. We can shop around, but we kind of understand what we're up against, which is we really don't have a whole lot of market power to drive down the prices, and that's why small businesses in Minnesota pay a considerably larger amount as a percentage for their health insurance than large businesses do. My hope and the expectation from the health economist who went through these numbers for us is that the expected savings is in the neighborhood of about 7.5%. And for my small businesses and most small businesses in Minnesota, if you can save 7.5% on your health insurance premiums, that's a lot of money. That's on top of the $150 million in savings as a result of no longer having the MCHA assessment. And finally, we just got a figure relative to the savings from no longer having as much uncompensated care from Minnesota Department of Health, and that savings is an additional $150 million. So you tally up all of these numbers and you have a pretty considerable amount of potential savings, not just for individuals and businesses, but for the state of Minnesota as well. The final point, and that is relative to oversight, which I'm sure that this committee is quite concerned about. There should be a page, if we haven't already had it placed in your packets, there's a page that we will see to it that you get, which is a summary of all of the oversight measures, some of which are federal in nature, but in Minnesota, those oversight elements will include, and part of this is has been coming through the committee process, all of the appointees to that board they're made by the governor, but they're subject to confirmation by the House and the Senate. In addition to that, we've got the Office of the Legislative Auditor that is expected to perform an annual audit, which the exchange is going to pay for. We've also got all of the typical measures within the Minnesota statutes that provide for if there's any sort of misuse of funds or fraudulent activity or those sorts of things. Those are also protected against by virtue of current statute. So there's considerable oversight, but the Representative Mack, I believe, had the amendment that was supported, I want to say unanimously, that brought in, and I'm glad that Auditor Nobles is here with us, that would also anticipate an annual audit. And I will let Auditor Nobles talk more in detail about that. But that's not just the finances. That's also the operations. He and his office have full ability to audit all of the procedures, the finances, you name it, within the and are expected to, on a yearly basis, do so with respect to this health insurance marketplace. And I appreciate and thank Representative Mack for making that amendment and the members of the past committee for allowing for that. Madam Chair, that's me talking more than I really wanted to, but I'd be happy to take any questions or concerns that members have at this point, or better yet, to hear the testimony from people that have probably traveled some time to get here.
Okay. Representative Aiken Atkins, you spoke faster than I could keep up with in a couple places there. But could you tell us about the exchange as a government agency?
It's a great question, and I covered that very rapidly and not very well. There's three options that we have in terms of how to set up this this entity. The one that we were originally inclined to do, Madam Chair, was a nonprofit housed outside and separately from state government altogether. The shortcoming of that approach is that it did not provide for access and enrollment into public programs. Moreover, it also was not subject to all of the various rulemaking, oversight, you name it, it wasn't subject to those laws. And we figured this body would probably want considerable oversight and an opportunity to make sure we have control over how it operates. So we moved away from the nonprofit. We considered the complete state agency approach and thought that that probably wouldn't be perceived very well either. So we ended up with a situation that I would describe somewhat akin to the PUC or the Minnesota Zoo Board, which is sort of in between those two extremes, but still has considerable government oversight and control, so that if legislators want to have their fingerprints on this, they can, but also has a nimble, market-driven ability to operate to respond to the conditions that may exist in the market.
And Representative Atkins, with what you ended up with then, this exchange that's kind of like the Zoo Board or like, what was the other one?
Like the Public Utilities Commission.
Public Utilities Commission. Is that going to be one of the, in our division, we have something called state agencies and then small state agencies. Is this going to be a small agency? agency or larger? And
Madam
the smalls Chair. Have probably 11 or 12 people working for them. They provide about 12 jobs or one job
yeah.
or three jobs or 15. But
and
the bigger biggies have 100 or 400 or 1,000.
Yeah, I know when.
Although we don't have 1,000.
If we talk about the PUC or the Minnesota Zoo Board, I don't know what category they fall into, but it's probably more akin to that. We've had, for example, we talked the other day about the Department of Commerce, and somebody said this will be bigger than the Department of Commerce. Department of Commerce has in the neighborhood of about 330 to 340 employees. This is anticipated to have 86. It has, I mean, now keep in mind we've got a call center that we've got to operate. That's part of the requirement is you have to have the ability if people have questions they can get on the phone and call for help. And then there's some folks that are outside of the operation. Agents and brokers, for example, are still anticipated to have a very significant role in providing guidance to people. There's a navigator position for people that can help people help potential customers kind of navigate their way through. They don't provide the sort of professional advice that an agent or broker would, but they can help people navigate their way through the online marketplace. So there's lots of folks outside. I don't know, Madam Chair, if that falls into the category of a biggie or a modest size, but maybe somewhere in between.
Okay. And Representative Atkins, can you give us any advice on who you're what legislative committee in the House of Representatives you think that this would fall under their jurisdiction?
You know, Madam Chair, that is a great question. I don't have a great answer for that yet, mostly because I'm looking to see what sort of input members of the legislature have. Whether it's state government finance or if it's part of commerce, because that's where the oversight will be. I just want to make sure that that there is oversight by the legislature, and where it rests is just fine with me. I think there's been, right now, most of the financing is going through MMB. It previously was housed in Commerce, there's an argument that could be made, perhaps it ought to be in Health, but the main thing is to make certain that there's that oversight someplace relative to the budget.
Representative Atkins, I move that House File 5, the fourth engrossment, be recommended to pass and be referred to Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Representative Atkins, you have amendments. Would you like to take them up now, or would you like to wait until we do the amendments at another time?
Madam Chair, I think it might be best do you have, are we coming back on Wednesday to do a variety of amendments?
Yes, indeed.
I thought that might be the case, and I would be fine with waiting until then to take up the amendments. There's one in particular, and if I might, we've been working with Representative Holberg and Representative Simon, who chairs the Subcommittee on Data Practices, as well as Chairman Lesh in Civil Law, about some suggestions that they have for protecting private data. I'm just not completely sure. I think everybody's on board with that. I'm not quite sure if that's the case, and I'd like at least another day or two to make sure, in particular, that Representative Holberg is and Representative Simon are thinking it's the best that we can do.
That's fine with me.
Thank you.
How would you like to proceed now?
Madam Chair, it's your committee. If you want to have me stand for some questions from members of the committee, I'd be happy to do that. Otherwise, I know that some folks have traveled considerable, at least time, if not distance, based on the weather conditions, and I'd love to hear their testimony.
Representative Benson, Representative Leidiger, Representative Howe, do you want to talk about the introduction that Representative Atkins gave, or do you want to save up until after the testifiers have testified?
Madam Chair,
Representative Benson.
My questions do go to the testimony that Representative Atkins has provided thus far. I'm sure I'll have more as more testifiers come to the table, but these are particularly to him.
You're first on the list, Representative Benson.
Thank you. Representative Atkins, You know, I was at a chamber event in Rochester on Friday morning, and one of the things that was emphasized a couple of times is the date and the urgency, you know, that we hadn't done anything for 2 years, and now we have this March 31st deadline looming. And I don't think anybody here would diminishes the fact that this is a very, very complicated bill. I think testimony in other committees, in fact, have, you know, people have said this might be the most important legislation since 1965, I think was Representative Huntley's comment. So it's a complicated bill, a lot of moving parts, a lot of responsibility, newly attained responsibility. I know this is something that we're motivated to do by the Accountable Care Act. But I, you know, in terms of it being that complicated, and I know there's been a group of people that have been working on this for quite some time, a couple key components that at least have come to light to me fairly recently is that, well, first of all, you can correct me if I'm wrong anytime, that this, in fact, this deadline has been moved back several times. So this March 31st deadline is one that's probably just been given to us probably late last year, November, December.
Madam Chair, Representative Benson.
Representative Atkins.
I think that's roughly correct. It came late last year, and it's March 31st.
Okay. So, Madam Chair.
Representative Benson.
So even this latest deadline with this complicated a bill, it seems to me that people probably almost certain that the Secretary is more than likely going to issue something else that backs this date up even more. But my question, at least my first question, goes to, from what I understand, that the basic plan parameters or mandates won't be defined or finalized at least until 2015. Now, you've stated in testimony that we've got to get this up and running and that people have got to have access to it beginning October 1st. Well, that's October 1st of 2013. How does that match with the federal government not being certain with what the basic parameters for the basic health care plan have to look like in order for us to meet that deadline?
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Benson. I think you are somewhat reaching a conclusion about the deadline and possibly being backed up. The fact is we've had about 2.5 years to get this done, and during the previous two-year period, I'm not pointing any fingers, I'm just saying we didn't make any progress in the last 2 years. This is the March 31st date, a hard and fast deadline. It is the first time and I think, in fact, there was the question that was posed to the Secretary or the feds about is there a chance that this will be backed up? And there is no chance. If we do not make March 31st, there will be a federal exchange. And we wanted to make sure that we had that clear, that there is no wiggle room with respect to the March 31st deadline. With respect to the basic health, I think you're referring to the basic health plan benefits on which there will be additional guidance, in addition to the fact that we've got market rules of our own that we will look to employ here. There's nothing, Madam Chair, nothing, Representative Benson, that prevents us from operating this health insurance marketplace without the basic health plan formula or benefits already outlined. The fact is we've got a relatively competitive but nowhere near as competitive market for health insurance here in Minnesota as we will once we get up and running in an online setting. And that's we're able to run that whether we've got the BHP guidance or not for what those basic health plan benefits will be.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Representative Benson.
So from what I hear, is your testimony that won't be an impediment in setting it up. There will still be the same amount of plans that we have now available that will be part of the new exchange. So if we've got 15 or 20 plans now that are capable of doing what the exchange will need it to do, that they'll be on the exchange. So can I extrapolate from your answer?
Madam Chair and Representative Benson, thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if that's precisely what I said, Representative Benson. There may be new products, additional products, different products that the plans put together to offer in the exchange setting. So to say it's going to be the same as we have now, maybe I misspoke a little bit, and what I meant to say is that we've got a situation right now that where we don't yet have full guidance from the feds in terms of what those essential benefits are going to be. We'll eventually get those, and those will be incorporated into the various plans. But that's not to say that we shouldn't provide for this very competitive setting to move forward at this time. And in fact, if we fail to provide that very competitive setting by March 31st, we know that the federal government is going to do it for us, or to us, as some would suggest.
Continued follow-up, Madam.
Representative
Atkins, then. So there is going to be some questions from the industry that will not be resolved by the time October 1st rolls around. Do you see that? I mean, from what I understand right now, the way the bill's written, the board, the exchange board, will have the sole ability to decide, even if they've met the criteria for certification, whether or not a plan is added to the exchange or not. Do you see that as an impediment to somebody, one of our insurance companies, going, you know, there's still so much ambiguity and questions about some of the issues involving basic plans and the like, and then there's no guarantee that we're even going to be admitted to the exchange. Could that cause some of our insurance companies to even decide not to become part of the exchange?
Madam Chair and Representative Benson. Thank you, Madam Chair. We're talking a couple different issues.
Sure.
First is the potential impediment created by the lack of guidance on what the essential health benefits would be.
Mm-hmm.
That is no greater or no less of an impediment than what is currently going on in the market right now. I'm sure that the plans would love to have guidance, as I would, for what they're currently offering in the marketplace. That isn't going to be any different, any less, any greater as a result of competing online for customers' business. Secondly, with respect to the issue you raised about having a board that is able to pick and choose which plans are able to compete in the market, I think you'll hear testimony from members of the or representatives of the health plans that would like to have more certainty. You know, if they meet a certain criteria, that they absolutely are going to be in. And you'll hear testimony on the other side of that issue would be that we'd like to have an opportunity to continue to work with, even if they've met the basic criteria. It's no different than trying to negotiate with them further on what sort of numbers of plans they might offer, and whether there's got to be a meaningful difference between those plans. Those sorts of things that the health exchange board or health insurance marketplace board would like to continue to have an opportunity to exercise.
Madam Chair and Representative Atkins.
Representative Benson.
So I'll have additional questions when that testimony comes forth in exploring that a little bit more. But you did make a couple of other claims in terms of the size, and I think this was either a question or a statement by Madam Chair regarding the size of this, size and nature. I've got a list of how much their operating base budget is in front of me. And Madam Chair, Representative, you can correct me if I'm not mistaken, but looking out at what's going to be expended by this new agency would make it equal to what's expended currently in the 14-15 budget by education, which would put it in the top 12-15 agencies in the state. Regardless of the number of FTEs, it still will be quite an expansive agency.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Benson, you know that most of that is just a pass-through to the plans, right? We're talking just no different than what's currently going on in Minnesota right now. People spend, I believe it's somewhere in the neighborhood of over $1 billion for health insurance right now. The actual operations of this board are about $56 million. But if you talk about, I think that's the connection you're making, is that, yeah, there's a lot of money spent on health insurance premiums in Minnesota. You're not going to get an argument from me.
And that, Madam Chair, then if we look at that number, it's as large as management and budget. So that is still a fairly good-sized number in terms of an agency. Madam Chair, Representative Atkins, one last question. I have scores, and I know there are other people waiting to ask questions. We need to get some additional testimony. You made a comment in terms of
it costing about 3.5%, well, it will be 3.5% that will be levied or taxed if it goes through the federal program. You gave us a new number that I had not heard today. 2.25, I think, 2.25% is what you thought. Could you provide, if not today, by Wednesday, for the committee, how you arrive at the 2.25% percent in terms of the actual cost of setting this up and what that number is?
Representative Atkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, absolutely. And it's not my number. That's we've got a health economist by the name of Jonathan Gruber out of MIT. Using some modeling that he's done, that's where I've drawn the 2.25% from.
Thank you. Madam Chair, in my last, is it maybe a comment? I'm aware of that report, and I'm kind of anxious to dig into it because there's some assumptions made in that that refute many of the comments that you made in terms of how much cheaper this will be for Minnesota families, with some comments in his report showing that it could rise as much as 29% to 43%, depending on where you're at. So I'm looking forward to a complete discussion of that report when we get it. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Benson. You're also, I'd guide you to the fiscal note. This isn't just Dr. Gruber's figures, by the way. The fiscal note reflects the 2.25% figure as well. And I suspect what you're referencing is the overall costs of implementing the Affordable Care Act. There are going to be people that will see increased premiums, but not as a result of having a competitive online marketplace, as a result of having additional requirements to comply with the Affordable Care Act. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Benson.
Representative Leidiger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question has to do with this initial opening comments as well, and I'll be short. Representative Benson covered some of it, but I want to go back to this estimate that if the federal exchange was created by the federal government, how is that expense derived? I know you stated that, but the reason why I want to kind of explore that a little bit is we're talking about a huge infrastructure that we're going to that this bill would create. And I think part of the questioning should start with really the need for having to do that, and that's a little bit unclear. A lot of people in my district don't understand it. Especially if the federal government is out there and they're creating these exchanges, and in fact it could be considered as, well, from if I'm in the private business, I'm saying, you know, I'm going to outsource certain things that are going to be done, even though it may cost a little bit more. And so I'm trying to understand, you know, we're only talking a 1% cost difference or thereabouts if the federal government creates this exchange versus us creating a huge infrastructure and creating it. I understand that where our figures came from, and I'm assuming that this Dr. Gruber, when he created this this study, that this is a generic study for all states. And that's kind of hard to understand how he comes up with that. But if you would answer, how do you derive this cost of the federal exchange system? How is that derived? And in fact, have we modeled this out as compared to a state-funded exchange? And in fact, can we actually get these costs down where we might consider this federal exchange? Please.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Leidiger, great questions. First, one clarification, which is that the modeling that's been done by Dr. Gruber was not a generic model for all states. It was specific to Minnesota. And we've got, back in April, he provided a full report, which had many of these. He then updated that in, I believe, November or December. And we've got a summary. We've got his final conclusions in that, and we have his additional data, the underlying data, coming along behind that as well. As far as the federal cost, the reason I know what the federal cost will be is because they've said so. They've announced that they're going to charge 3.5%. And we just thought when we looked at it here in Minnesota that why would you just arbitrarily set a number? If we can do it for less than that, and still provide a better product. And we think without question we will provide a better product. If for no other reason than if you have a concern or complaint, it'd be much better to dial a 651 number than a 202 number for Washington, D.C. But the cost is quite significant. When you're talking about, let's just say that we're talking about $1 billion in health premiums, health insurance premiums. If we're talking a 1% difference, Representative Leidiger, we're talking $10 million. That's $10 million that is coming right out of Minnesotans' pockets. So if we can do this for $10 million less than what the federal government would do it for, and we think we can do it better, in fact, I don't just think it, I know it. There's no question in my mind that we can do this better if it's operated locally. In fact, that's kind of a Republican theme song, I think, Representative Leidiger, and it's certainly one from a former mayor. I think we do much better when we do things local than when we send it off to Washington, D.C. And I think that kind of suffices.
Representative Atkins, could we, has it been determined that it's going to be a 651 number? Could it be a 218 number?
Madam Chair, I was actually going to suggest a 218 number.
I think that would be really smart.
And we actually have your home number listed in the in the bill itself, Madam Chair. If anybody could be helpful on this, Madam Chair, I would think it would be you.
So, Madam Chair, can I follow up on that?
Representative Leidiger.
Thank you. That's a good answer, but have we looked at the federal exchange program? I mean, when I look at vendors, when I look to outsource, I want to know how they derive their costs, and it seems to me we should have some sort of input on how they would go about doing it. I mean, would they be opening offices here within the state? Would they consolidate it in Washington? I mean, it seems to me we could squeeze an existing system, especially if they're going to have experience doing that in other states. It seems like we could squeeze some costs out of this thing to where we don't have to build a huge infrastructure that I worry about. So these are questions that I would want to explore first, or we should have good answers on that, have really drilled down on that prior to us even considering our own exchange.
And Madam Chair, Representative Leidiger, I couldn't agree more. But you know what? We got a March 31st deadline where if we don't do this by March 31st, we automatically get what you just described. And if I was going to outsource it, my little law firm, we just built a new building. If I was going to hire somebody to do the custodial work there at that little law office, and they just came in and they told me what their price was going to be, 3.5%. Let's say that's $500 every couple of months or every quarter or something like that. But they wouldn't tell me what they were going to do. I wouldn't hire them, Representative Leidiger. And that's what we got from the feds right now. They're not telling us what they're going to do other than they'd operate an exchange. They haven't told us if it would be local offices. They haven't told us it would be local numbers. The one thing they've told us is what the price tag would be. I ain't buying. What I'm buying is I'd much prefer, one other quick point, and it bears mentioning, is we got a pretty good system here in Minnesota. Every health plan that I've heard of, every provider that I've heard from here in Minnesota absolutely wants a Minnesota-grown, Minnesota-run health insurance marketplace, not a federal one. And I'm guessing most consumers would say the same thing.
And Madam Chair, I'm just saying it's extremely difficult for me and a lot of my constituents. I mean, it's as though we're going to take on this bill and we're going to consider, building this, and we have very little knowledge on what the federal government is doing. And this is the federal government. They should be open with how they intend to do these things. This arbitrary date is of the March 1st? 31st? Can we get an extension on that so we can explore how the federal government intends to do this? I don't want to spend the state dollars, and that's a big pocket of money, without really understanding what our alternatives are.
Madam Chair, Representative Leidiger, we are not spending any state dollars. We asked about March 31st.
Yeah.
They said no. There is no wiggle room on the March 31st. So I'm not here to argue with you. I'm just saying we asked. The answer was no, and we know what happens April 1st. which is we get the federal exchange, which I guess April 1st would be a good day for that. And we've purposely made it so that this is not going to, well, the Senate version now does have some state general fund dollars because they're using the tobacco money. We do not plan to do that in the House bill.
One last question.
Representative Leiter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The 3.5%, when we talk about the cost, that's the cost to the individual that would register on that federal exchange. There aren't any costs to the state. It would be the cost to whoever applies. Am I correct on that?
Representative Atkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Leidegger, if I'm understanding the question, the it would be a withhold from the amount of premium that would end up at Blue Cross or at Medica or Preferred One or whomever. So if your premium would be $1,000, keep in mind the exchange is doing the eligibility determination, the enrollment, and other, and providing call centers and all of those people. Is that the health plan would receive $35 less. My hope, though, and I haven't heard this from the plans, my hope is that they'd be saving some amount of money by not having to do the eligibility stuff and the enrollment, the administrative work that's associated with that, on top of the fact that they're anticipated to serve another, I want to say there's 300,000 uninsured Minnesotans that are expected to get their coverage through this. So it'll be bringing in a whole bunch of business that they don't even have to market for. It's just automatically expected to go through this. That's the uninsured people, and 1.3 million total Minnesotans are expected to get their coverage through the online marketplace.
Okay. Thank you. I'm still a little unclear about
that. I bet in the next day or so we'll get
more
clarity as much as we can.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah. Representative Atkins, two times now today you've mentioned the Senate, did they pass the funding as a cigarette tax or is it the tobacco bonds? I'm unclear.
And Madam Chair, I'm a little unclear too. I'll admit I haven't read the language that the Senate put in, but I believe that they're taking existing money that's coming in from tobacco taxes, and rather than using it for general fund expenditures for which it would normally be spent, they're going to divert some of that money and use it for the operations of the health insurance marketplace. And if I'm wrong, I'm sure somebody, there were plenty of folks here, Madam Chair, that have been following both the Senate and our version here.
I would think that would, Representative Atkins, just keep in mind for when I imagine we go to conference on this issue, that would be very unstable because people are going to stop smoking pretty soon. And all this new dependence on cigarette taxes or tobacco taxes is very unsustainable then if people are going to listen to the TV ads where the person shows us how she prepares for the day, and it's very bad. And so I don't think that's very stable, and so we'll go forth with your plan.
Madam Chair, I'll let the Senate know that.
Yeah, thank you.
And I'm guessing that they'll just accede to the House version because we've spent more time on it here.
We would hope.
So,
once again, we would hope. Representative Kahn?
Well, Madam Chair, that's the advantage of looking at the whole budget as one piece. The amounts of saving and health costs would very greatly exceed any tax revenue we would lose from that. So,
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Atkins, I guess, you know, in your opening statements, you said that you really wanted this to be part of the rulemaking process. And I guess in that, then, I have to, so from my understanding, if we're going to make this part of the rulemaking process, are the appointees then going to go through the rule of the open appointee process in Chapter 15?
Madam Chair, Representative Howe, you're mixing a couple of different, there's rulemaking and then there's the initial appointment of the board members. Part of the initial appointment of the board members is we don't have quite as much time as we ordinarily would to go through the process that's laid out in law, because we have to have the appointees right away in order to comply with the with the federal requirements in order to have it up and running and in operation by January 1st. So we've got a little bit of a shortened process for the initial appointees, and then it will roll into the normal appointment process that follows in years to come. Does that answer your question?
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So how long are these initial appointees appointed for that are going to set this up and identify those insurance companies that get to participate in the exchange?
Representative Atkins.
And Madam Chair, Representative Howe, all of the health insurance plans are allowed to. There's nothing that precludes any of them from participating in the exchange. They will have to meet a certification. First, they've got to meet the Department of Commerce requirements. Then they've got to meet the certification requirements to be in the to provide a product. And then they're subject to additional negotiation with those, or, you know, if they offer 17, the board would reserve the right to say, just give us your three or four best. That's what we're talking about. But your question then also was, how long would they serve? And it would then be staggered terms of 2, 3, and 4 years. So they would come up and be a staggered fashion, with the governor making the appointment, and then under the House language, they'd be subject to confirmation here in both the House and the Senate.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Representative Howe.
Thank you. And then the so as far as the board goes, in Chapter 14, they have to abide by the salary limits then that are set in Chapter 14?
Representative
Madam
Atkins.
Chair, Representative Howe, thank you. They would pay their employees what the market would bear. So if it takes, for example, right now it's really hard to hire an actuary for something at 85% of what the governor makes. It's challenging to hire somebody to be the Minnesota Zoo Board director for something less than the governor makes. So there is no, as I said in the last committee, this is America. We pay people what they're worth. If it takes more than what the governor makes in order to hire people into certain positions, I believe that's what ought to be done.
So then you should say, then I would exempt out that, then why do we have that rule that only limits? Shouldn't we pay all employees in the state of Minnesota what the market bears? But that isn't the case, is it, Representative Atkins?
Madam Chair and Representative Howe, we're getting a little far afield from the bill, but I think you could make an argument for that, is that we lose some very, very good employees here in Minnesota to the private sector because we can't, by law, we can't pay them what the market will bear.
To the point of the health exchange, Representative Howe.
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair. I also, you identified that there's going to be savings, about $500 to $700 per family. And you mentioned that Mr. Gruber did a study specifically on Minnesota. And I'm looking at an article here in November of 12 that he actually says that individual market premiums in Minnesota will increase by an average of 29%. So could you provide us written stats on how these families are going to save that $500?
Representative Atkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Howe, would you mind giving me a copy of what you referenced?
Absolutely.
I'd be happy if I might. What article are you referencing?
I guess I got to put my glasses on. If you want to, I guess it's an article in Forbes magazine, and it references.
I've read it. I just wanted to know which article we're referencing.
Representative Atkins.
Ms. Chair or Madam Chair, Representative Howe, the figure that you're citing is before the tax credits are applied, and as I said, the Affordable Care Act, by virtue of the fact it's a guaranteed issue, you can't turn anybody away anymore. You've got to accept everybody with pre-existing conditions. I think there's nobody in the country that would argue that premiums are going to go down as a result of the Affordable Care Act. The fact is they're probably going to inch up. But when you have, then you take that and you buy your product, your plan through the health insurance exchange, two things happen. One is much more intense competition. The second is the availability of those federal tax credits. So when you apply those two items, Dr. Gruber and others would tell you that the average family in Minnesota is going to save about $490 a year, and some will save considerably more than that. But for those of us that can't avail ourselves of the federal tax credit, I fully expect to pay more. Not because of the exchange, but because of the Affordable Care Act. It's a guaranteed issue and coming, and we take all comers, whether they've got pre-existing conditions or not.
Madam Chair.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Addison, so you can provide us that $500 or $490-some dollar. You can provide us those stats on how those families can expect to save those dollars?
Madam Chair, Representative Howe, yes. That's not my figures. That's Dr. Gruber's modeling and his expectations.
Madam Chair.
Representative Howe.
So can I have those? Can the committee have those before Wednesday, please?
Madam Chair, Representative Howe, I'm not sure what's in your packets at this point, but as I said earlier, there's Dr. Gruber's original projections were from back in April with all of the underlying data that comes along with those, literally in the scores of pages. We had those figures updated, the exchange staff had those figures updated in November and December. And I believe if you don't have those, I will make certain that you have that delivered to you. The one thing that we're missing is the underlying information that came, just as it did with the April, the scores and scores of pages that come along with it. I don't expect that to change considerably, but those would be updated as well. But we do have all of the conclusions and all of his summary data.
Representative Howe.
I look forward to seeing that. Thank you.
You bet.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And just listening to some of the questions here, I still would like to go back to Representative Benson's question, and I don't think we got a good answer in terms of the agency budget being a pass-through type of budget. And I see that Catherine Comet is here. Could she come down and maybe address that question?
Representative Detmer, we're on questions about the opening remarks right now, and then Ms. Kimmett is the first person that's on the testifying list when we get to the testify.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll go ahead with my comments and questions. Again, we're looking at a big super agency here in terms of setting up the online infrastructure. I'm looking at the budget out to 2017. We're looking at approximately $179 million. Now, I had a constituent call me. I'm sure everybody have constituents that calls you about what's going on with this health exchange and the federal government. And also being a K-12 educator for 34 years, we know what the federal government has done with in terms of special education funding. Promising, mandating special education, and then funding us instead of 40%, I think it's around 17%. So, you know, I don't think we can be sure that the federal government is going to come through what they say they're going to do. Representative, you can't promise us that. You know, nobody here can promise us that, what the federal government would do. But my constituent made this comment to me, and I would like to get your response, is you're looking at all the money that we're spending on setting up this exchange, and you know we're looking at, I have a pie chart here of number of people and how they get their insurance. We got about 5.3 million people in Minnesota. 24% are fully insured in terms of HMO indemnity, different programs. 38% of the people in Minnesota are insured with self-insured plans. 14.8, almost 15% are insured with Medicare. You have 13% with the MA, JMNC, MinCare, and we're looking at about 3% of the people in Minnesota that are uninsured. So say we're talking, this, what, 160,000 people. And my constituent said, well, what the amount, if you look at the millions of dollars that we're spending on setting up this exchange, why don't we just give grants to the people that are uninsured and help them, let them go out and buy insurance? That's my question.
Representative Atkins.
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Detmer, number one is we don't have that authority. the dollars that we've received are, to date, are federal dollars. We can't use those for anything other than setting up the framework for the marketplace. As far as the underlying point that you made in terms of the promises of the federal government, specifically, what are you referencing? What are you concerned that they will not continue to provide?
Well, you mentioned that,
Denver.
Madam Chair, you mentioned the amount of money that the federal government is going to be coming up with. What if they don't? What if it doesn't work? What does Minnesota do after we've put the exchange in force?
Madam Chair, Representative Detmer, are you referencing the federal grant funding or the tax credits? Because some of these promises we know are going to end. I don't expect to continue to get grant funding forever. We've had to apply for each one to date, and this is not the kind of thing that we anticipate ongoing federal funding for. That's why I'm a little at odds, or maybe I'm missing something.
Representative Detmer.
You mentioned, Madam Chair, you mentioned that how this is going to be funded in terms of charging those that are purchasing insurance online. And then where is the rest of the money coming from then? Is it going to be fully funded by that?
By the up to 3.5, is that what you're asking, Representative Detmer?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Representative Atkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Detmer, that's where we're going. Is that we have, in fairness, we've gotten $110 million in federal grants to date. And I wouldn't be surprised and would expect that we'll continue to get some, but the way that the operations are funded are via the up to 3.5% withhold. We're not talking, in 2020 or 2025, I don't expect to see any or rely on any federal money. The hope would be that the federal tax credits will continue. But with or without those, the benefit of having a competitive setting in which to purchase one's health insurance, where you can get an apples-to-apples comparison of products, that has a benefit in and of itself.
Representative Denver.
Well, I think I agree with one of the statements you made, is that Minnesota does do a better job. And I think we are doing a very good job now with our insurances. And I also agree that the federal government is mandating us to do this, but I think if you listen to any of your constituents, they really question the where the federal government is going on this. So that ends my comments.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Detmer, I always pose the same question: would you prefer to have it be federally run or state run? And if we don't do something by March 31st, it will be done by the feds. And imposed upon us with the system that we think works, as you said, works pretty well in Minnesota. And to a person, every single person that has answered that question has said they would prefer a Minnesota-run version over a federally operated or imposed health insurance marketplace.
Members, we are just past the usual time that we start this committee, and I want to thank you for coming early and for being so engaged in this process. It's, as has been stated by Representative Benson, perhaps the most important bill that we're taking up since the 1960s. And so your questions and observations are very meaningful, and Representative Atkins, I'm sure, will take this along the way to the many stops that he has yet to go before he comes back with a finished product. And I just want to thank you for this time, and I want to thank you for the time that is yet to come on Wednesday, when we're going to combine part of our regular agenda with House File 5 in addition. And then Wednesday evening, for as long as it takes, up to midnight. But we will be voting on this bill before midnight on Wednesday. So, Representative Atkins, that being said, you got to take another breath. And Representative Kreshaw.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
On the introductory remarks, we are still on questions about the introductory remarks that Representative Atkins made
so
an hour ago.
So, Madam Chair, I have a hard stop at Wednesday at midnight.
Hard stop at midnight, yes.
Representative Atkins, first of all, thank you very much for bringing this. And as I watch the demeanor and the way that you handle yourself, as a small country legislator from up north, I'm very impressed. So I can imagine the amount of information that you've had thrown at you, so thank you. I'm just very curious. You said a couple of things that resonate with me as a small business and entrepreneur, the competition. And it sounds like there's a fully embrace mantra there, which is great. How many insurance companies do you anticipate will be able to come into the exchange and offer their products?
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative, is it Kreshaw?
Correct.
Representative Kreshaw, I expect any and all would be able to avail themselves and would hopefully be desirous of wanting to sell products in the in this market, because there's an anticipated 1.3 million people that are expected to buy their health insurance, and specifically 300,000 people in Minnesota right now who do not have health insurance who are expected to purchase there's I believe there's 500,000 Minnesotans without, or about 9% of our population, who don't currently have health insurance, and they're expected to purchase it through this vehicle.
Follow-up, Manager.
Representative Kreshaw.
Excellent. So, Representative Atkins, as you and as a small company yourself, do you see any impediments to a smaller insurance company not being able to get into it? What would make it harder for them than, say, one of the major players, a Blue Cross, Blue Shield, Health Partners?
Madam Chair, Representative Kreshaw, I'm a small lawyer, country lawyer from Inver Grove, and I got to compete every day with these folks in Minneapolis that have all kinds of advertising on TV, and they've got lots more things than I do, but the bottom line is, as long as I still have an opportunity to get there, no offense to the big shots in Minneapolis that do this, but I think small firms always have that big advantage over the largers, which is your ability to craft products that meet specific needs and do a little bit more client service, and I would hope that small carriers that make that pitch, and no offense to the larger ones, I know that they do great customer service as well, but there should be, other than just the typical impediments of they have more money than I do or they have more resources than I do, there shouldn't be any additional impediments by virtue of having an online. If anything, I think it provides a better ability for them to get their product out there, for more people to know that. As you get over 1 million people that go online, there's going to be kind of a sorting out, and if you got a smaller company that doesn't have the advertising power, the marketing power the larger one does, but can put a really good product out there, I think it just makes it even better for a small entity than a larger one.
Representative Kreshaw.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, and so that brings me to the other, as I look through this, and we have, when I sit down with an insurance broker now with my company, we'll run through the whole litany, and now we'll be asking that same service of the website or the navigators, correct, of how you're going to sort out these companies. And some of them, of course, are going to have better plans, and some are going to have less. And I can see the matrix. I can see how it's coming together. Who's working on behalf of the consumer to say, you know what, this is the one I'd really like to see you go to because it fits your family profile better? I mean, it seems to me we're losing some of that with just the straight push of a button, fill in some dots, and hit submit.
And
Representative Back.
Madam Chair, Representative Kreshaw, I think you hit a great issue on the head, because even with my own law partners, I know we're going to have a little back and forth over we like our broker, like him a lot. My hope would be that the agents and brokers would have an opportunity to just, you know, this would be one more tool for them to use. But for my son, who's, 20 years old, when he gets to be 25, 30 years old, he might be in a position where he's still able to just sit down, purchase his own health insurance, and not necessarily avail themselves of the services. Hopefully he'll call me, and I can give him a little bit of input. But it sort of embraces all of those models, whether it's somebody who feels able to do it and they've got a pretty simple decision to make. It's just for them or just for their family. Or if it's a little bit larger business, it's still trying to make decisions, but would benefit from the use of having an agent or broker's professional advice.
Representative Crenshaw.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You touch on an excellent point. In fact, I just heard this from one of my constituents. He had had an issue, and he had been able to go to his broker, and the broker really was the one that navigated him through and essentially ended up with payment. It seems to me that step may be missing now. If I have a claim and I really am in a dire situation, who do I go to advocate? Am I going back to the website? Am I going directly to the... It seems to me I might be now losing my small broker who can come in and who's been a family friend forever and say, you know what, we're going to take care of this for you, like a good neighbor.
Madam Chair.
Representative Atkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Crenshaw, I just spent two evenings ago with my local State Farm agent at a girls' hockey game, there's a lot to be said for, and I'm a big fan of agents and brokers. Some folks aren't, and they can probably do this on their own. And in fairness to the folks at the health insurers, my guess is that they would also say, if you got a problem, we've got customer service people, and this is, you know, they can speak for themselves. But please call us. You know, you can call your agent, but you can also call us directly, and we'll try to address your problem. We'd like to keep as a customer. I don't want to put words in their mouth, but I'm guessing that's what you'll hear from them when they come up here to testify eventually. So there's a lot of different ways to get some help. I don't think we're excluding anybody from the process. If you feel more comfortable having somebody help you, be it an agent or broker. The main thing if I'm an agent or broker, though, I'm looking at this as you got 300,000 Minnesotans who currently don't have coverage. If I can just land me a few of those folks, that would be of help. You've got a bunch of businesses and so forth that hopefully we'll be able to get even more competitive online competition that will allow them to generate a better figure for their cost of their health insurance. So I think there's a lot of possibilities.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Atkins, Ms. Roberts. Mr. Shepard prepared a brief summary of the fiscal notes summary for the agencies within our jurisdiction. And I would like to get a quick review of those at this time so we have an idea of exact figures as are mentioned in the fiscal note.
And
but
Madam,
we're not, I don't want to do the whole fiscal note for the whole bill, but for those agencies in our jurisdiction.
And Madam Chair, to that particular point, I believe, Mr. Shepard, that one of the amendments that we'll take up on Wednesday was to make sure that there was absolute clarity about where these dollars are being spent from, and that they are not coming out of the general fund here in Minnesota. And perhaps he can allude to that as well when he talks about the fiscal. Now, we just want to make sure that there's complete clarity about the fact that we're not looking to use general fund dollars for this
sure.
for this effort.
Sure, and when Ms. Roberts gets to that, we'll let Mr. Shepard talk. Ms. Roberts?
Madam Chair and members, the Chair was referring to the handout that's in your packet that doesn't have a title on it, but outlines the four agencies that are specifically within the jurisdiction of this committee. This was prepared by Mr. Shepard. I'll go in the order of the handout. It's a little different than the order in the fiscal note, but just so people can follow along. The first agency that's within the jurisdiction of this committee is Minnesota Management and Budget, and you'll find that discussion beginning on page 37 of the fiscal note. You'll see that the numbers page is not showing any direct costs to Minnesota Management and Budget, and then the narrative discusses the specific portions of the bill that have requirements for MMB, the first being the requirement to to operate the exchange and then submit the compensation plan to MMB for their review. And MMB has said that does not have an impact on their budget. The next subdivision, Section 6, Subdivision 3, requires the MMB commissioner to establish requirements and compensation for insurance producers. The fiscal note states that this is work that is done on a regular basis by MMB and so it does not have additional fiscal impact. The third item, Section 6, Subdivision 4, requires the commissioner to establish requirements and compensation for the in-person assisters programs. Again, the fiscal note says this is work that MMB does on a regular basis. The fourth item, Section 6, Subdivision 4C, requires the commissioner of MMB to establish a toll-free number for the exchange, and it does note that the costs for this toll-free number are included in the health insurance exchange portion of the fiscal note. And finally, there's a requirement for the commissioner to exercise all of the authorities and responsibilities that are created, and that this, again, would not have an additional fiscal impact on MMB. The next department that's within the jurisdiction of the committee is Department of Administration. That's going backwards a little bit in the fiscal note, but it begins on page 33. You'll see that on the expenditure and revenue, or what we call the numbers pages, that there is identified $16,000 in costs that would be covered through a miscellaneous special revenue fund. And then in the narrative of the fiscal note, when you look on page 35, the costs that are being discussed there are for a portion of an acquisition management specialist for 6 months, or for a portion of time. And this would do with, this would be as a result of the additional procurement duties that the Department of Administration would face. And then you'll also see on the table on page 35 that there are additional expenses above the $16,000, but that these would be covered by federal grants that have already been received or are anticipated to be received.
And Ms. Roberts, that special revenue fund that they're going to get the $16,000 from, is that an ongoing fund for the department, or is that from the health exchange?
Madam Chair, the way I'm reading the fiscal note, but we do have someone here that could clarify that if you want, is this would be an interagency agreement with the marketplace for a period of 6 months. But they can clarify that if they need to. The third agency that's under the jurisdiction of the committee is the Office of Enterprise Technology, or MINET. And that portion of the fiscal note begins on page 39. You can see again in the discussion, there's an outline on page 40 of the different requirements that the bill would, how it would impact OET, and that OET or MINET, excuse me, I'm always going to call it OET out of habit, has worked with the Health Exchange Program and the other agencies to identify the IT impacts, but those specific impacts are included in the Health Insurance Exchange Program portion of the fiscal note and also within the Departments of Health, Commerce, and Human Services and Admin. So MINET has reviewed the bill and has responded to the fiscal note, but the specific IT expenditures are included in the specific agencies, not in MINET's portion of the expenditures are included in the specific agencies, not in MINET's portion of the fiscal note. And then finally, moving on to the legislative auditor, that's again moving backwards in the fiscal note to page 31. And again, showing no impact on the expenditure and revenue page. And it notes that the bill authorizes but doesn't require the OLA to audit or evaluate the Minnesota insurance marketplace. And if it was such an audit is required, it would be done by reprioritizing the OLA's existing resources. And again, I think Mr. Nobles was here if you wanted further information on that.
I is there anyone on the committee that has additional questions? Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Atkins, I'd like to give you a copy of this if I could. I had a chance to go out to the Health Exchange website and take a look at the information that's out there relative to the updated Gruber-Gorman analysis. As I was taking some time to go through it, I really didn't see where the savings that we've been talking about today would transpire. I was wondering if maybe you could just help me with that.
Representative Atkins.
Madam Chair, thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. I'm not certain, Representative O'Driscoll, if it's in this particular item or not, but I will, if it'd be all right with you, I'd be happy to provide that. I just don't know what you printed off the website.
Excuse me, Representative O'Driscoll, is this about the fiscal note?
Madam Chair, no, it's just referencing some of the stuff that Representative Atkins had testified on earlier about some of the savings that would be experienced as a result of the exchange, and he referenced the health insurance exchange, and I went out there to grab a copy of that to see if I could maybe just dig in and get a little bit of an understanding about what some of the savings were. I just simply provided him a copy of that because I wasn't able to make heads or tails out of it.
Madam Chair, rather than, as I page through the 25-page document, why don't I visit with the exchange staff and we'll make sure that we get you the document that I referenced, because I'm not certain that this summary that you provided me necessarily is that, and rather than waste 50 people's time, it probably doesn't make a whole lot of sense to do that.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I was searching the website, that was the only update that I could see under the Gruber-Gorman heading on there. So if I'm in error on the particular document, I'd like to take a look at that, but that was the only one I was able to locate. So.
Fine. Let us go back to the fiscal notes that Ms. Roberts was talking about. Is there anyone from MMB or administration or OET minute or the legislative auditor's office that wants to speak to those fiscal notes and their effect on their agency? If so, come forth. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Barb Julek, and I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Exchange within MMB. So I guess I'm MMB today.
Good. And do you want to express MMB's happiness to comply with the responsibilities that the exchange gives to you or your agency, and that how MMB is going to make this Minnesota proposal work?
Madam Chair, the exchange would work with current MMB staff, the commissioner, and his delegates to work through these duties and ensure they occur.
And it will be seamless.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you. Auditor Nobles.
Madam Chair, Jim Nobles, Legislative Auditor, and I thought I would just give you very briefly kind of our financial situation, and we will be back to present that to you in a comprehensive way, and that's really the way we would like to do it, because it has been my practice for many years that when we are asked to do additional duties, that I do not at that point ask for additional funding. That's what we did when the legacy amendment passed, for example, and we received added responsibility to audit, evaluate, investigate any issues related to the money that came from the four legacy funds. So we have accumulated additional responsibilities over the years, and I think it's time to present those to you. How we cope with that is to prioritize and strategize. We have responsibility to audit everything that goes on in the executive branch and the judicial branch. So depending on how you count it, we probably have well over 200 different individual organizations, from very large to small, to audit. And we simply decide, again, on the basis of how we can best utilize those resources to audit the organizations that need to be audited. So we will be back, Madam Chair. I know that from time to time there are people who are concerned about our stretching of resources, and so they try to give us money to do the thing that they would like to be at the top of our priority list. If that is the will of the legislature, that is the will of the legislature, and we will, of course, follow that. But what I prefer to do is get an appropriation, not that fully funds all that we need to do or should do, but gets us to a point where we can have enough resources to really look at those things that need to be looked at on an annual basis in terms of the priorities and our strategy and our strategic plan. What we do in terms of dedicated funds after we get a general fund appropriation is to rely on what is known as the indirect cost allocation system. And that's something this committee has been familiar with in the past, and some new members might want to become familiar with. It is a way to say that when the general fund supports certain activities of state government that help activities that are funded through dedicated funds, such as Game and Fish, Legacy, Trunk Highway, and then potentially the funds that will be used from a dedicated account for the insurance exchange, we have a system for charging those funds for those services, and then money from those dedicated funds is put back into the general fund. That is the system that is used for the Office of the Legislative Auditor. It's used for a number of sort of general support activities of state government. And so at the end of the year, we provide the Department of Management and Budget with some hours that we tracked that went into auditing over at DNR, for example, Game and Fish, or at Transportation, Trunk Highway, various other organizations for Legacy. And then they charge those funds, those dedicated funds. That money then goes back into replenishing the general fund. That is the system that is in place. It is the system that I think works reasonably well. But again, if there are members and it is the will of the legislature to directly appropriate some dedicated money to heighten the priority of doing certain work, that is certainly your prerogative. So, Madam Chair, those are my comments. We certainly take this and every other responsibility that you give us very seriously. The legislative auditor does have very powerful authority to go into organizations and audit on your behalf. We will be able to see all the data that is available at the insurance exchange and to do a really in-depth examination, both from the standpoint of audits, evaluations that could cover a wide range of issues. We also have authority to investigate any allegations of inappropriate or illegal use of public money. So all of that authority will be available and will be applied to the insurance exchange as it is needed. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Auditor Nobles. Representative Atkins, when this bill was being created, House File 5 was being created, and we were talking about this exchange, was there adequate discussion of the costs to the legislative auditor's office?
Madam Chair, quite frankly, there was just the inclusion, might have even been at my insistence, I can't remember, but that it ought to be subject to review by the legislative auditor. And that was the extent of it at that time. Since we didn't know if there would be necessarily audits or not, we didn't build in any sort of pricing for that. But as Auditor Nobles indicated, they have responsibility for it. I would invite them to perform audits, and I think what Representative Mack proposed in the previous committee makes a great deal of sense. Whether it's paid for through the marketplace or paid through legislative allocation or appropriation, doesn't matter to me. I just want to make sure that it's that it's available to the legislative branch to have done.
Representative Atkins, I would think that with the added responsibilities that there would be some funding available through the exchange.
Madam Chair and members, the through that up to 3.5% withhold, those are the funds that are available to the marketplace. We built in language that provides that if we can get grants from the McKnight Foundation, or if there's marketing that takes place, other sources of revenue, or if there's future federal funds, I'm not counting on any of that other than the up to 3.5% withhold to pay for this. I would note, and I'd be remiss if I didn't at least mention it, there's an independent audit that is required by the federal government for this, and we consider that part of the oversight. I believe Mr. Nobles believes that that independent outside audit would be paid for by the exchange. It's my understanding from Mr. Nobles that this may suffice to satisfy the federal requirements which the exchange was required to pay for. So I with all due respect to Mr. Nobles, I know that he prefers to not have the funding spelled out specifically in the bill. And I would prefer that as well, but the fact is there's going to be an audit, and the exchange was and remains prepared to pay for that as necessary.
And Representative Atkins, we will be talking about this again at another time when you're not present, and so I want the committee members to remember this conversation, because that's when we're funding the amount of the legislative auditor's office for all the duties and responsibilities that all legislation includes for that office, we have to remember that it's a growing sum. Auditor Nobles.
Madam Chair, I appreciate Representative Atkins mentioning the federal requirement. It is a very typical federal requirement whenever a responsibility or money is passed to the states that the federal government adds an audit responsibility. We are the auditor that fulfills that responsibility. We conduct every year what is referred to as the single audit under the U.S. Single Audit Act and certain OMB circulars. And so I did inform the insurance exchange that our single audit will fulfill that responsibility for them. But just so you understand, we fulfill the responsibility for all of the audit requirements throughout state government that come attached to any federal money that the state receives.
For all.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Yes. Thank you. Representative Preshaw.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To that specific point, or can I was, as they're talking about numbers, I was just wondering, I'm going back to the premium as they come down. May I ask a question on that?
You may.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Atkins, as I'm going through and as I've been spending some time with the Gruber report, and I know it's a big question how these premiums come down. So, as a former CFO and as I understand this, the way the premiums will come down is because we are taking on a larger pool of risk. Is that correct?
Madam Chair,
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Krisha. I believe it's a multi-pronged. There's arguably the larger pool of risk, but there's also the premium will be impacted by two other things. One is enhanced competition that, quite frankly, some would argue is existent in the market, most would argue is not. And that enhanced competition will drive prices down. And then we can't overlook the fact that by virtue of buying through the exchange, you will be able to avail yourselves of the federal tax credit, which are significant as well in the hundreds of dollars.
Okay, Representative Creechaw.
Okay, so thank you, Madam Chair. So just, and if you could just indulge me for a minute, I'm trying to run through some numbers in my head to make sure I get this. If this exchange launches, and just for, and 100,000 people sign up. Do we know what those and here's what my real question will get to. What is the break-even point? I mean, we're saying
The exchange will enroll over 1.2 million people, and there's numbers that it could be 400,000, could be 600. There's a couple other pools. Is there a number that we've run or that you've run that says at 450,000, it starts to drop, the premiums start to drop?
And, Madam Chair, Representative Kreisha, I apologize for not. There are. I didn't bring those in my folder today.
Okay.
There's a high enrollment, a middle enrollment, and a or medium, and a low enrollment model that's been done. And under the highest enrollment, we actually, the figure that I've quoted in terms of about 2.25% of the premium withhold comes from sort of an average enrollment. There's another version where we have higher enrollment sooner, which should cause that price to be down even more into the 1-point-something percent. But I didn't think it was fair to members to be quoting something that just expected the doors to open and suddenly to have 1.3 million people enrolled. So I took kind of the more modest middle of the road figure, which was at 2.25. And Madam Chair, I will make sure that you get the there's literally the modeling that that goes through those high, medium, and low enrollment options. I'll get those to you.
Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, so there is a number out there that says at X, that's our target, and we want to be above that. What incentives are in place to be above that target? I'm thinking my business world, obviously, if I want to enroll 500,000 people here, I'm going to put incentives in place because at 490,000 we're losing, at 510,000 we're gaining. Mm-hmm. What incentives may be in place for that?
Representative
Atkins. And Madam Chair, Representative Kreisha, for this entity, it's considerably simpler than that. The chief incentive that that is offered through this marketplace is the fact that it's a marketplace, and that you've got 1.3 million people anticipated to enroll via this effort, and 300,000 of whom who currently have no insurance whatsoever. So the incentive to the plans, to the carriers, is to be in this because it's an opportunity, and I would think, as you pointed out earlier, for smaller folks that don't have the marketing dollars, perhaps it's some of the larger folks do, an opportunity to compete on an apples-to-apples basis in a marketplace like this is quite an incentive, I would think.
Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so there is an incentive, and I'm just trying to go through the experience of setting up, and do we have this navigator next to them that's trying to incent them to get on, or, I mean, are we going to have great people out there with clipboards trying to find people to enroll? I mean, how are we going to get some of these people that are in hard-to-reach places in to hit those targets, to hit those numbers?
And, Madam Chair, Representative Kreisha, that's on the opposite side. I thought you were talking, what would incentivize folks to put their plans?
I'm sorry.
If I'm a consumer, honestly, the chief thing for me, I talked about the competition, but if I'm able to get a tax credit and save hundreds and hundreds of dollars as a result of it, I'm going to buy through my computer, guaranteed. And if there's a little bit of marketing, I suspect it won't even have to be that much. But if there's a little bit of marketing that tells people about what the tax credits are and how to get them, people will automatically be driven towards this. And I'm guessing if I'm an agent or a broker and I have an opportunity to sell through this, I'd probably send that out to my current clientele and advertise that as well. So I think there's a lot of ways that are going to drive consumers. The final piece is that there's the Navigator program and the in-person assister programs that are, and the Navigator in particular, which is folks that already have connections to the community through whatever other services that they provide. I'm guessing that they'll be a great vehicle for getting information out about the marketplace as well.
Representative Kreisha.
Final follow-up. And I appreciate all that. And so as I'm thinking through this in a practical, as I think of my small town, the pool of people that may not be insured now because they're not comfortable with a broker, they can't. How are we going to get to those? It seems to be there's going to be a gap of people here that we want into this exchange, but maybe they don't have great technical skills. Maybe they're not comfortable. Maybe their education level isn't such. They're not following a lot of this stuff. It seems to be there's going to be a gap of people. How are we going to get to them?
And Madam Chair, Representative Kreisha.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that's why the assister piece of this, the call-in centers, and the navigators are so absolutely critical, is because those folks, I wouldn't say that they necessarily would substitute for an agent or broker in the professional advice that one would get from an agent or broker, but they literally will have guaranteed, or they won't get certified, they'll have the technical skills to help you walk through this process online. And they'll have the sort of networks to reach out to those communities. And we've had discussions along those. It's not just English-speaking communities. It's other communities. It's not just individuals. It's the small business market. It's reaching out in a fashion so that you meet people where they're at and help them work their way through this process. But I think there will be a lot of drivers that will assist in that, not the least of which is the opportunity to, well, you have to have health insurance by federal law, and this is the only place where you can get credits, and the federal tax credits, and those are big drivers towards this sort of effort. Yeah.
Representative Creechaw.
Last final question. As it stands today, would you use the exchange?
Madam Chair, Representative Creechaw, I think so. I got to talk with my law partners about it because, as I said, we've got, a really good relationship with a fellow that helps us with our insurance needs, some of our investment needs, and a variety of other things that we do. I suspect what will happen is it will be kind of a hybrid version. We'll work with him and probably go online and look at various products that are available and how they would meet our needs. My guess is that the individual market will probably be more likely to avail itself of this, and I think we're going to have a lot of folks that are going to want to do that. If I didn't have it through employment, I would without question go online and try this out.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Back to the information on the fiscal note. Auditor Nobles, Representative Benson, and Representative Howe have additional questions. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's got in my packet at least two audits, an audit at least, and a news story. Could probably get the audit, but nevertheless, the audit that you folks did on SWIFT, on the statewide integrated financial tools, and we're not going to go all the way through that in this. I'm going to keep it limited to testimony regarding your work and in the fiscal note, and then the NPR story about. I mean, it's their words, failed Minnesota health match, failure in IT, and so on. This would seem to me to be a much larger endeavor than either of these. And you've been around. I trust you immensely. I think you do a yeoman's job with the staff, the budget that we give you to make sure that we're doing things right, and after we've given responsibility to agencies that they're doing things right, I guess I would like to, I know this is opinion, but I mean, do you see any issues regarding how we've rolled? I mean, to me, there just seems to be, with the amount of time that we have left to March 31st and the kinds of things that we have laying before us with all the uncertainties from the federal government and so on, do you have any issues or thoughts regarding, from an auditor standpoint, in missteps, trouble, problems that might arise from this?
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, and members, I always have concerns and anxieties about all of our data systems, particularly those that contain not public data. That's why many years ago I set up a specialized team of auditors to do just IT security audits. Unfortunately, I've had to rebuild that team three times, because the first one was hired away by OED and is now the state's chief security officers. The second team now works at Minsky. But we do have a very good third team to go out still and do this work. And it is very technical work, but it's extremely important. And so you just referred to one of the audits that team did and found issues, and we raised those in the findings of that report. We are currently just completing an IT security audit at the Department of Revenue, and you can imagine the concern that auditors and others would have about the security of data within our revenue system. Once that one is completed, be over at the Department of Education. So again, it is part of what we do. I have to say, and I don't think I'm saying anything that I can't support by the reports we've issued, we've never found a system that was fully secured. And I don't know, frankly, in this world of hackers and internal intrusions, which are also an issue in any data system, that you can ever build one that is totally secure. But you certainly have to work towards that objective. You have to be aware of the vulnerabilities, and you have to design systems to both prevent, if you can, but certainly to quickly detect any inappropriate use of data. You've all, for example, been very aware of the issues related to intrusions into the state's driver's license system, another one that we are investigating and looking closely at. What I would suggest you do at some point in this discussion about the insurance exchange is that you have Chris Boozy, who did used to work for me, and is currently the state's chief security officer for all of the state's data systems, works at OET, to come and explain to you what they have done in the building of that of the insurance exchange system to try as best they can to prevent any intrusions, inappropriate use of that data, what kinds of security they are building into that system, and what systems of monitoring they are developing to try and quickly detect and act upon any inappropriate, either external or internal, intrusions into the insurance exchange. So that's our experience. I think it's one that every organization, frankly, in the public and private sector, has to worry about. We are all completely dependent on these data systems. They are very powerful, very sophisticated, but they are also vulnerable. So, Representative Benson, I think it's a good issue, and I would invite you to bring in Mr. Boozy to talk to you about it more thoroughly.
Madam Chair?
Representative Benson.
Yeah, I'd ask if we couldn't add to our testifier list the recommended person to have come at least testify and give us some background on what the system would look like. Maybe take 5 or 10 minutes, but I think it would give us maybe some additional questions. I'm concerned about financing, the proper amounts of resources necessary to safeguard the data. And I have a follow-up. If you could, just for this, because I think it does have implications on understanding what you just talked about, a little bit more of the detail on the health match, how that...
Yes, Madam Chair, members, Representative Benson, some of you remember that experience. Some of you are new, and it may not be something that you experienced. But for a number of years, the Department of Human Services, with federal money, tried to build what was called Health Match. And it was a system designed to establish a computerized eligibility determination for public-supported healthcare insurance programs and delivery systems. There were significant problems with it. First of all, it was being built because there are, and frankly continue to be, a lot of issues around just eligibility determination. It's very complex. There are many variables, and so obviously people wanted to utilize the power of computers to try and have people come in, input certain data, and make a determination as to what programs they were eligible for, including MenCare, by the way. In fact, one of the reasons we looked at Health Match was because we had a lot of issues about eligibility determination and the errors that were being made in eligibility determination for Minnesota Care. And the Department of Human Services was very aware that there were error issues and was going to rely on Health Match, this computerized system, to solve those problems. But over a number of years, there were issues, and ultimately Health Match failed. And the state lost a significant amount of money in the development of that. There was sort of shared responsibility and blame between the vendor that was hired to do the development and the Department of Human Services. We did issue a report on that issue, again related to Minnesota Care, but the real issue was Health Match. Health Match, we hoped, was an experience we would learn from, and I hope we have learned those lessons and are going to be following them so that we can not have the same issues that occurred with the insurance exchange that we had with Health Match. So it was one of those efforts that was not successful.
Madam Chair and Auditor Nobles, just for the record, can you remember that report, how much money we the state lost in that endeavor?
Madam Chair, I don't off the top of my head. It was federal money, but I consider federal money paid by Minnesota mm-hmm. taxpayers also to be public money. So there was a significant amount of public money that was lost, but I don't remember these. It was tens of millions of dollars.
Madam Chair,
Benson.
$30 million, ring a bell?
I would have even gone a little higher, but if you have it in front of you, maybe you know, but it was a significant amount of money.
Okay, and Madam Chair,
Representative Benson.
I don't have any more additional questions from Mr. Nobles, but I have a few for Representative Atkins. Do you want me to wait till after Representative Howell's questions to Mr. Nobles?
Yes, please.
Thank you.
And then we have four people that want to testify.
I have only one, Madam Chair, one more question after this.
Representative Howell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have one question for Commissioner Nobles and then one for Representative Atkins. Mr. Nobles, could you relate the size of this database and the sensitivity of its information in this database to anything similar that we have in state agency today?
Madam Chair, members, Representative Howell, you know, since it is still a work in progress and we haven't examined it, I can't fully answer that question. I anticipate it's going to be a large and very sophisticated, complicated software package, and it will involve a large database. But that is, frankly, not too unusual for state government. You know, our driver's license database has millions of records in it. SWIFT, the one that was referred to earlier, is a very large, complex database. So we have these. Just frankly, the current systems that we use for payments, for MA, for all of the various programs, are very large databases and software systems. So this one is not out of the range of what we deal with in state government, but I would certainly say it is large and complex and will undoubtedly contain some sensitive data.
Any other? Representative Howe? Okay. Any other questions about the fiscal note? Representative Crenshaw.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just Commissioner Nobles, on your account of very large database and sensitive data, and this doesn't have to be answered as we can even do it with a testifier, but I'm just thinking of the very vulnerable people in my district, the elderly, the Hispanics, and some of the people that are going to need to put their very sensitive data into this. How are we going to ensure that? What kind of training requirements will be? I'm just envisioning a situation where somebody is walking an elderly person through this and taking their sensitive data and trying to help them through that. That's the weakest point, in my opinion, of where fraud could happen. And that I'm just wondering how that's been accounted for. Maybe you have training requirements built in, but with the onslaught of identity theft and all that, I mean, that's some incredibly sensitive data.
Madam Chair,
Director Nobles.
Members, yes, I mean, I don't diminish the importance of it. It's very important, and there are many different points of vulnerability and potential fraud, again, both external and internal, but I don't diminish that. This is what we do in state government a lot. Unfortunately, sometimes I don't think we do it really all that well, or we don't certainly do it well enough so that we can assure people that their data is protected. That's why we first do the best we can, both at a human level and at a technology level, to secure data. But then I think it's very important, as we build these systems, that we build in systems of monitoring to detect quickly any intrusions, either external or internal, and respond to them quickly. As I might add, we did do, thankfully, at the Department of Natural Resources to detect the inappropriate accessing by a conservation officer into the driver's license data. He was fired. Criminal charges have been brought against him. I think those are the things we need to do when people do misuse data for identity theft or any other reason.
Representative Crenshaw.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just a quick follow. I mean, if a DNR conservation officer can break blur those lines of morality, what's going to help prevent a navigator who's maybe way down and not nearly the training requirements? I mean, I just think, imagine I've got to go back to my district and tell some of my Hispanic population, just let the person, the government agent with an iPad into your home to help you out. That's not going to go very well if I can't put some assurances to say, you know, that they're not here to all the bad things that you can imagine. They're here to help you. So I just see, and you don't have to answer, I just see some blurring there, some very difficulties of somebody who's maybe just at an entry-level government job, trained in, and what's going to prevent them if a conservation officer is going to blur those lines. So just concerns I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Crenshaw.
Madam Chair, just on this on subject here with Commissioner Nobles, the question's for Representative Atkins. I'm just curious, Representative Atkins, do you agree with Commissioner Noble's characterization that federal money is state money?
Representative Atkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Leidiger, I'm not really tracking. I don't see they're all tax dollars, I'll grant you that. But once the dollars are either federal dollars that are then granted to the state, and the state uses those dollars, but that's about as much as I can.
Okay, it's the people's money, I guess. No matter whether it goes into the federal or the state pockets, but that's allotted back to the state, we treat it as state money. It seems like, at least that's what our auditor. That's the way I understood the auditors to define that. And then I have another question later, I suppose, for Representative Atkins.
Thank you.
I think I'm on the list.
Yes, this was it.
Oh, this is it?
My question, then?
That was it. Is it about the fiscal note?
No.
No. All right. That concludes, then, our conversation about the fiscal note at this particular time. There are four people that have indicated that they might want to testify. And the first person on my list is Catherine Commit, Minnesota Council of Health Plans.
Thank you,
Commit.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We have up to 5 minutes.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Catherine Commit, and I represent the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Our members include Blue Cross and Blue Shield, Health Partners, Medica, Metropolitan Health Plan, Preferred One, Sanford Health Plan, and UCare. My colleagues and I have been working very closely with Representative Atkins, and we appreciate all of the hard work that he has put into this important legislation. The Council of Health Plans has always supported universal coverage for Minnesotans, and as well, the creation of a state-based health insurance exchange. Just in picking up on Representative Atkins' earlier comments about how will this entity be run, how will it work, and how will it be paid for, I will keep my comments narrowed to that, those subjects. So first of all, we have some concerns about language in the bill that gives the board the authority to decide which health insurance plans can be offered through the exchange. This concept is commonly known as active purchaser. Put simply, even if a health plan or insurer meets all the stringent state and federal requirements for selling insurance through the exchange, the 7-member board can pick who can and cannot sell products through the exchange. The bill does not outline any criteria the board must use, nor does it create a transparent process. It clearly limits the marketplace and therefore limits consumer choice. The federal law requires a whole host of new processes and quality metrics that a plan must meet to be considered a qualified health plan. The criteria for participating in an exchange should be objective and based on criteria set by the federal law and the Minnesota Department of Commerce. Furthermore, if the goal is to maximize choice and competition, which consumers and employers want, then the exchange should be an open marketplace. the active purchaser concept will limit consumer choice. Our question to you is, if a health plan is able to meet these high standards, then why wouldn't it be allowed to participate in the exchange? Why would the board want to limit consumer choice? In terms of how the exchange will be run, we have an additional concern about the high cost of operating the exchange and how the exchange will be funded. The federal law requires that health insurance sold in the exchange must have a benefit package that is larger and more expensive than the benefit package many people have today. The federal law also requires lower deductibles and lower copayments than insurance plans currently allow. As a result, these new federal requirements will increase the cost of health insurance for many products in the individual and small group market, making health insurance more expensive. The state hired two consultants, and they've been mentioned here, Jonathan Gruber, a health economist, and Bella Gorman, a health actuary, to analyze the impact of the health reform law on the Minnesota market. In their 2012 report, Gruber and Gorman estimated that the impact of the requirements of the federal law may increase premiums in the individual market in a range from 26% to 46%. Gruber and Gorman estimated premium increases in the small group market to vary even more, from a range of negative 22% all the way up to a positive 28.5%. Keep in mind, these are the premium impacts estimated before either the federal or state premium taxes and assessments are added. It's also before the tax credits are added. In addition to the premium increases due to federal health care reform, is the added cost of paying for the operations of the exchange. House File 5 requires a 3.5% premium withhold or premium tax, which will be added to the cost of the health insurance purchased by individuals and small employers. We strongly oppose this tax because it falls disproportionately on the subset of the fully insured market. Larger employer groups such as the State Employee Group Insurance Plan and self-insured employers will not pay for the cost of the exchange. The Minnesota Exchange is a state public good and will operate for the benefit of the entire state. The exchange will also perform eligibility determinations for about 700,000 enrollees in the state Medicaid program. Why shouldn't all Minnesotans help to pay for the administration of the Medicaid program? The exchange should be funded using a broad-based mechanism that is fair, equitable, and accountable to the legislature. I know I'm almost out of time. I do want to just make one, I'll skip ahead and just say that when you add the new federal taxes and the new state premium tax to the increased cost of the health insurance products sold through the exchange, we are very concerned that these products will still be too expensive for individuals and small employer groups. If health insurance sold through the exchange is unaffordable, even with the federal tax subsidy, then we would actually end up with more uninsured Minnesotans, not fewer. Again, we could actually end up with more uninsured Minnesotans, not fewer. I have more comments, but I see I'm being given the high sign, so I will end my remarks there, and I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
We'll have questions after all the testifiers, okay, if you don't mind waiting. And Representative Atkins, you might take notes in case you want to rebut any of this at a later time.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Representative Otis.
Pardon the interruption, but given the nature of the topic, I think it'd be helpful when someone testifies to be able to ask questions of that and get some interaction. If we run out of time today, that's going to be 48 hours from now that we're going to be bringing people back, and hopefully that they'll be able to be back, that their schedules will accommodate on that. My personal desire as advice to the chair would be that we have the opportunity to ask as the testifiers come up to be able to interact with them. I have a very important question, I think, that goes to something that I mentioned to Representative Atkins before that I'd like to ask this testifier on, because they're completely opposite ends of the spectrum on what they've testified on.
I appreciate your counsel. K.A.K. Johansson, Minnesota Chamber.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think she's in another concurrent committee testifying in that one. She's Kate Johansson from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce.
Kate. Okay. Twyla Brace, President of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. Oh, Ms. Johansson.
Madam Chair and members, first I apologize that I'm out of breath. I just ran through the tunnel without shoes on. And this is the second committee in which I have done that in the last 10 minutes. But I'd like to introduce myself. My name is Kate Johansson. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and its 2,400 employers. 80% of them are small businesses that are eligible to participate in the state health insurance exchange. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House File 5, and thanks also to Representative Atkins for his hard work in taking on this very complicated and important issue and his collaborative approach to dealing with the many stakeholders who have concerns about this bill. Certainly, the Minnesota Chamber has concerns about the bill in its current form. We could not support it. But that being said, we have long supported the legislative creation of a state health insurance exchange, and we continue to hope working towards that goal. Excuse me, we hope to continue working towards that goal with Representative Atkins so that we can achieve an exchange that will work for Minnesota consumers. We do have issues in four main areas that I'd like to address today. Those areas start in the area of governance. We have two primary issues under the area of governance that I'd like to address. The first is board composition, and the second is conflict of interest language. So with respect to board composition, the language that is currently in the bill doesn't properly address the need to have those with experience in impacted industries on this board. Minnesota has a long and proud tradition of cross-sector collaboration, of having people serve on its board, having people serve on government boards who understand the areas that are being regulated. This bill does unfortunately diverge from that tradition. Also, unfortunately, we're concerned that as drafted, it doesn't meet federal requirements that there be a majority of those with technical experience necessary to regulate the industries that are impacted by this bill. I think that an appropriate alternative would be to envision rules for specific stakeholders on the board or to look more closely at aligning our language with that of the federal regulation. We're also concerned about the conflict of interest language. Now, certainly, some folks are very concerned about this language, but what we're concerned about is having the right balance. And we think that recusal is a small price to pay to have experience, and that experience is not corruptive, it is constructive. And that's why we would say that it would be more appropriate, rather than taking the language in the bill currently, to look at what the task force recommended, which is that a small number of folks who are on the board be allowed to have a conflict and just recuse themselves when they're voting on a matter of material importance. Additionally, we have concerns in a second area, which focus around the duties and responsibilities of this exchange board. Primarily, we're concerned with the active purchasing power. Now, I understand that active purchasing is somewhat of a toxic term, but whatever you call it, active purchaser, active selection, we're more concerned about the policy than the name, and the policy here has a bad effect. It's that you have a board of seven people with a four-person majority that can pick winners and losers, that can exclude products that meet criteria developed to protect consumers from the marketplace. And we think that's a bad public policy for consumers for a couple of reasons. First, consumers like choice. They benefit from it. When I talk with our small business owners, what their primary concern is being able to find products that are meeting and tailored to their needs as an employer. They don't want less choice. They want more choice. And second, we're concerned that this does disincent fans to participate. You know, they could be following every rule, meeting every guideline, and at the end of the day, be arbitrarily excluded from this exchange marketplace, even though they have met all the criteria that both the federal and state government have laid out in the name of consumer protection. And a third reason that is very near and dear to the Chamber's heart is that we think this dampens innovative purchasing models. Many small businesses are interested in looking at what's called defined contribution, wherein a small employer who struggles very much to budget for health insurance could just say, I'm going to give you a certain amount of money and you go shop for it, perhaps on a state health insurance exchange. Well, if there aren't enough choices to let that person have some sort of actual choice on an exchange, a small business owner doesn't have a lot of incentive to shift to that model. And that's why we think that the widest possible proliferation of choices is the appropriate resolution. Certainly, I would never criticize legislation without offering a constructive alternative. And here I think the constructive alternative is a clearinghouse model as opposed to an active purchaser model. According to the Kaiser Family Foundation, 6 of 13 states that have declared a model have declared that they're going to have a clearinghouse model. You might ask, what is this clearinghouse model? And basically it's this. It's that instead of letting a board exclude or keep certain plans or products out of a marketplace. What you have is a board that sets, you have federal and state criteria that are set and developed to protect consumers. And if plans meet those, they can enter the marketplace. And consumers can have the widest possible choice available to them. And I think that that is the appropriate solution. You know, a few people might say that buying health insurance is too overwhelming and that we need fewer choices so that consumers aren't overwhelmed. And I would say that, yes, sometimes a lot of life's choices are overwhelming. But in this instance, we have invested $41 million in a website to simplify this process. And we have excellent brokers. As Representative Atkins even noted, he loves his broker. And I love mine, too. And we have navigators. We have an excellent support system that will help assist in this process. We're also concerned about accountability, which is of particular interest to this committee. This is basically a de facto state agency with tremendous power and without reciprocal oversight. I mean, it is exempt from rulemaking. It is effectively transitioned to be accountable only to itself after a certain amount of time. It will employ almost 100 full-time employees, exclusive of things like a call center, and it will cost tens of millions of dollars. And the funding that goes into that dedicated fund is not subject to legislative appropriation, as other dedicated funds are. And I think that's an improper delegation of legislative authority, not to have oversight of that fund. With respect to finance, that's the final issue that I'd like to touch on of concern to the chamber. I'll just say that the 3.5% withhold currently in the bill, as I see I'm out of time, amounts to a tax on small business, and small businesses cannot afford to pay more in premiums right now. They're facing a 2% increase from the federal premium tax coming in 2014, a 3% MCHA assessment, all the regular taxes and fees that they pay that other insured consumers do not. And also, they would be paying this in 2014, even though the state already has federal funding to operate the exchange in 2014, so it would be a year before it's even necessary. Also, it would be before the MCHA assessment had been phased out, and I think that it's premature to state that this is some sort of cheaper alternative to MCHA when that MCHA assessment would continue on top of a 3.5% withhold. We're eager to work towards the bill to improve it, and I'm happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Johansson. Mary Jo George, you wish? Is there anyone else that came to testify? Representative O'Driscoll for Ms. Commit.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Commit, thank you for returning. I do have some questions. You were representing that some analysis that your organization has done relative to the Gruber-Gorman analysis from 2012, that premiums would end up going up and in some cases could drop, but are seeing an increase, which is in stark contrast to what we had heard at the beginning of our discussions today. That premiums could go down on an average of $500 per family. Can you give us a little bit more background as to where you got those numbers and the analysis that you've done to help with that?
Ms. Commit.
And Madam Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, yes, there have been some comments made about how prices, there will be savings, but as Representative Atkins did mention in his testimony, there are going to be some increases that result from the Affordable Care Act, just all of those provisions going into effect. So that's going to adjust the benefit set, the enrollee cost sharing. Those are all going to have an impact on how much the product itself is going to cost. And for the most part, it's probably going to be more. In fact, we know it's going to be more, and that's what Gruber and Gorman have modeled in their earlier report. In fact, an essential health benefit set for an individual to now be purchasing the essential health benefit set, it's predicted that it will go up by 8% to 11%. For merging the MCHA market into the individual market, that could have a 10% to 15% increase. Just the new risk, people who haven't been insured coming into the market and the individual market, could be a 15 to 20% increase. And so all of these things are going to result in quite a bit of fluctuation, I think, once the exchange goes live. And so for some people, primarily younger and healthier people, individuals, their insurance premiums are likely going to increase. For people who have individual products, who are older and perhaps have more health conditions, they may see their the cost of their products either stay flat or possibly even go down. We don't know for sure, but so there is that interaction that's going on. Then on top of that is the health insurance exchange, which is this portal through which individuals and small businesses will be able to shop and purchase health insurance coverage. The way that the health insurance exchange is being paid for, based on the language in the bill, is that there will be a 3.5% premium withhold or premium tax on all of the people who purchase through the exchange. Whatever their premium is, 3.5% of that will be extracted and will be used to pay for the ongoing operations of the exchange. What's a little unclear is that we don't know how many people are going to be in the exchange yet, because we, you know, this is still such a new thing. We don't know exactly how many individuals are expected to enter the exchange. So it's interesting that the budget itself, I mean, I've looked at the fiscal note and the budget, you know, based on my read of the fiscal note, which was prepared as the bill was introduced, so, and the bill has changed a little bit, but you know, my reading of the fiscal note on page one of the fiscal note for fiscal year 2015, I came up with close to $83 million for the operations of the exchange. Now, that's probably going to be a little bit different today because of some of the interactions that have happened as a result of an amendment that went on to address some of the broker and agents' concerns. But nevertheless, I think a good question for this committee would be, well, what is it that this that Minnesotans are going to be getting for this amount of money, whether it's $60 million, $50 million, $83 million? What is the value that this is going to accrue back to the to Minnesotans for creating this portal?
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the point that was made by Ms. Kmit, keep in mind that we're talking, when we talk about that 3.5%, we're talking about a guaranteed 3.5% withhold if this is a federally imposed health insurance marketplace. And under the bill in the House, we're talking about up to 3.5%, which we've got estimates is more likely to be about 2.25%. And I suspect if we were to ask Ms. Kmit which she would prefer, an arbitrary absolute 3.5% or something that is less likely, if we do it in Minnesota, I suspect I know what the answer would be. But the real issue that has not come up that I'd appreciate is the cost of to the plans of that they currently incur, which is for enrollment and determining eligibility and doing the underwriting and so forth. Most of that is going to go away if people, well, most all of that goes away if they enroll through the insurance marketplace online. There is no eligibility determination. There is no, they will be enrolled as soon as they hit complete or submit, and there's no further underwriting. And I'm just curious if there's been a calculation, Ms. Kmit, for what that amount is. Is that 4%? Is that 5% of the cost of the premium? Is it more than that? Is going to be the savings. And in the Senate version of the bill now, with general fund dollars paying for this, can we expect health insurance premiums to go down by 4 or 5 or 7 or 10% or something like that?
Representative Atkins, that was sounded like a rebuttal.
It's a rhetorical question.
You were supposed
Madam
to do
Chair.
Your rebuttal after the questions were over, but there's three people that have questions in addition to Representative Driscoll's follow-up for Ms. Kmit, and two people have questions for Ms. Johansson. So I don't know if even the testifiers were prepared to answer questions, but
I suspect, well, Madam Chair, that that might have been Representative O'Driscoll's next question. I just posed it for him. Mm-hmm. Is that correct, Representative O'Driscoll?
Representative O'Driscoll.
Throw me a bone.
We have 9 minutes left.
The question I guess I do have is, the document that I had provided Representative Atkins earlier refers to this as the updated Gruber-Gorman report, and this committee is using a document based on 2012. It is my sincere hope, because I've been asked to, when I've seen this at other committees, to hold off all fiscal and financial related questions, which I dutifully did till we got to this committee. I am hoping that we will get this a chance to revisit this on Wednesday and see more of a side-by-side comparison, because we absolutely have two different ends of the spectrum saying heads and tails. And I think that this committee needs to know and probe that question.
Well, that's the purpose of this committee, Representative O'Driscoll, is to talk about the financial things. And you know what? By Wednesday, all of us are going to have a copy of that report. And so even everyone that didn't have a chance today will have a chance to read that report before Wednesday even. And so we will be able to have a more complete discussion, I think.
That is a side note, because Representative Atkins asked if that was my question. I guess I would be curious to hear Ms. Commit's response to the question.
Ms. Commit.
Or statements posed by Representative Atkins.
And thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. In response to the questions that you posed, Representative Atkins, I think it's, in fact, I'm glad that you brought this up, because what we're really talking about is a very small number of people who are going to be going through the exchange. When we hear about 1.3 million, well, close to 700 to 800,000 of those people will be on Medicaid, and they're already being covered today. There will be some people, so they're going to move through the exchange, and that's going to be the same process that we have today. The remaining 300,000 to 400,000 people who will be coming into the exchange, many of them are covered already today, but they're going to go to the exchange because they'll have an opportunity to use the tax credits, which will help make insurance more affordable for them, because currently they don't get any kind of financial assistance that way. But to Representative Atkins' point about, well, we won't have to do underwriting, we won't have to do marketing and all of these other things, actually I don't think that's quite accurate, because we're still going to have a robust marketplace outside of the exchange. And so those functions are going to still have to be done, not only for the market outside of the exchange, but the only people who are going to be using the exchange are individuals and small employers. There are larger employers between the size of 50 and 100, who are fully insured, so they buy insurance, they're not self-funded, but they're not going to be impacted by this law. So there's still going to have to be those ongoing activities to work with those employer groups, both inside and outside of the exchange.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, I look very eagerly look toward Representative Atkins' response to the information that I was able to locate on the website that he and others have referred to on this. Just simply giving us the report, as you've suggested, maybe somebody can make heads or tails of it, but I see no actuarial data to support this. Spreadsheets that just have numbers that are in there, and those can be put in at any point or with any underlying assumptions, and none of those are footnoted in here, so I look forward to that. The other thing that I ask if committee staff could do for Wednesday, I'd really like to have somebody from the Department of Commerce and the Insurance Division here, because I'm starting to get come to the conclusion that we have a duplication of efforts in here, where the exchange is going to go through some due diligence on policies and then make some recommendations and approvals. We already have the Minnesota Department of Commerce that is doing that, and so will some of those commerce employees lose their jobs as a result of the exchange going into place because they're no longer needed, or will those individuals be merged and moved over into the exchange to do the same or similar job? I guess I'd like to hear from the department what their thoughts are and what they currently do in that process. I think that's important as well, since, again, we are a financial and a fiscal committee, that we start hearing those kinds of things, because jobs could be on the line on this as a result of the exchange.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I didn't mean to interrupt Representative O'Driscoll, and far be it from me to engage in rebuttal at this point, but rather than have that hanging question out there for the next couple of days, there is no anticipated job loss whatsoever, nor is there any anticipated impact on the operations of the Department of Commerce. They will continue to operate just as they always have, performing oversight and approval of plans that are submitted for their review. The actions and efforts of the health insurance marketplace are entirely separate and different from what the Department of Commerce does, so that we don't have folks wondering whether or not they're going to lose their job as a result of a comment that was made in committee and then languished for a couple of days.
And Representative Atkins, this bill was first heard in the Commerce Committee, was it not?
It was, Madam Chair.
Yes, and Commerce Committee has jurisdiction over the Commerce budget?
It does, Madam Chair.
And we have jurisdiction over budget management and legislative auditor and administration and OET.
And Madam Chair, could I just make one more comment? On page 28 of the fiscal note, for those of you who have it, at the top of the page, it does talk about the impact to the Department of Commerce, because the department will have to, it's going to increase the compliance and enforcement responsibilities of the department by increasing the scope of regulated conduct and number of regulated entities, and it will, you know, this new entity will expand the opportunities for fraud and other inappropriate deceptive practices, so that's going to have to be overseen as well.
Have you concluded your questions, Ms. Commit?
I have. Thank you.
Representative Benson, Ms. Commit.
Thank you. And this could be for both. I actually am a little surprised at some comments that have been made by Representative Atkins in a positive way, mind you, in that I've heard words like free market and competition on more than one occasion for various parts or components. But I still hear from you, ma'am, that a big issue about the active purchaser, the clearinghouse model, and so on, and then some additional comments. I think, you know, I maybe came a little jaded, I guess, so to speak, with what I thought we were going to hear, simply because in other committees from the health policy chair, that she didn't see a need for a lot of variations of opportunities for health insurance companies, because that would make it too confusing. I think the story that she rendered was a trip to the grocery store. I see a smile on Representative Atkins' face. But
just,
a serious
conversation. I love all the analogies.
Yeah, a serious conversation in that she went to the soup aisle and she was so conflicted by the number of choices that she couldn't buy. And she related that to the average Minnesotan adult going to a website and looking at all the choices and going, oh my gosh, that's just way too much. And that she's, you know, basically saying we need to limit the competition. And I see that. I see a problem there because I've heard a couple of different things. First of all, I guess I agree with the testifier that I think to have a robust system that allows for good competition, that we have something in this bill that says if people meet the criteria, state and federal, that they should be allowed on. There shouldn't be a board playing an arbiter on this. And then also hear then from Representative Atkins some sensitivity to free market competition and on a number of issues. So I guess the question to you is, do you see the limiting factor of not knowing that if you're going to be accepted or not, even if you made all this criteria, as an impediment to many companies deciding whether or not they're going to follow through to apply for certification?
Madam Chair and Representative Benson, there is a great deal of uncertainty associated with this exchange, and there's a lot of uncertainty because we're awaiting the federal government to make some decisions about things. We want to compete on the exchange. We want the exchange to be successful, and we want to end up in a situation where we have more people covered, not fewer people covered. But because there's so much uncertainty, and in particular around this active purchaser model, if we meet all of the state laws and regulations by the Department of Commerce and then meet all of the federal regulations to become a qualified health plan, only to find out that when we get to the finish line, that a 7-member board made a decision to allow some plans in and others not, then I think, you know, these companies are going to stop and think very long and hard about whether or not to make the financial and resource-intensive investment in developing a product to bring to the exchange.
And Madam Chair, and Representative Atkins.
Representative Benson, no.
To that point. It's to that point. And I'll be brief. Representative Atkins, we're going to be delayed now until Wednesday. Is it possible, based on apparently you're walking towards the light in terms of competition, to a possibility of a friendly amendment that would allow for a language in your bill that would allow anyone who makes a criteria to be part of this exchange? Could we work on that between now and Wednesday?
Madam Chair, I'm more than willing to look at any possible amendments and work with any members. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You are willing to look at any possible amendments and to work with any committee member?
Absolutely, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. Our time for this meeting has come to an end. Ms. Johansson, Ms. Commit, there are still people that have questions for you. If you would mind returning at another time, you can talk to Ms. Conley about what approximately that time might be. Members, would you put your the bill and the amendments in your save file in the folder? And Representative Detmer.
Yeah, Madam Chair, just real quickly, you know, we've been talking this whole committee meeting here regarding the exchange. Would it be possible when we meet next time, Wednesday or Wednesday night, that somebody could come in and bring up the website and actually take the committee through how to go through the website and how to get on the exchange? Would that be possible? It would be good for us to see that process.
I don't know. I'll check into it.
That could be put on the monitor, and they could take a step-by-step and how to get through to get on the exchange.
I don't know. This meeting is adjourned.